statute is similar to the currently existing authority for agency heads or other officials to delegate rulemaking authority to other people inside the agency. We believe that the bill could be improved by simplifying the process so that delegation wouldn't have to be to a particular named person, especially when we're talking about agencies where there are thousands of orders and people come and go and move from one position to another. In other words, the larger agencies, the bill would probably be better if the delegation process were just simpler. But we also believe that as it is, the bill is a significant improvement by virtue of clarifying the authority to delegate. Now, I know I've run through this fairly quickly. I'd be glad to answer questions if the committee has any questions.
Ms. Schutt, I do have a couple of questions. Would this bill apply in those instances where the statute refers to, say, the director of an agency or the superintendent of the agency? I mean, that's fairly standard statutory language to refer to the chief person, the head of an agency, as having the authority. Is that the case you're attempting to deal with?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's exactly it. Where the statute says frequently you'll see language that says that either the board may do such and so when talking about a state board or commission, or where you're saying the director may do such and so, and in some cases even people below the director level have specific statutory authority to deal with these things. This bill would allow those people who are mentioned, and if there are people mentioned, to delegate that authority to other people so long as the delegation was in writing.
Mm-hmm. The bill refers to an officer or employee of the agency. Now, those of us who work with corporations understand the term officer of a corporation. That's a statutory concept. Is there a universal concept in state statutes about state agencies about who is an officer of the agency?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's not particularly, but I think that's in there out of an abundance of caution. There are some agencies, obviously employee is a fairly clear concept, someone who is works in exchange for remuneration. I think the officer idea is intended to scoop in people who are maybe specific volunteer board members who are not employees of the agency but rather sit on a board or commission. And also there are elected officials who might not be considered to be employees of the agency in particular situations, although that would be odd to allow those folks to delegate. I think it's just intended to make sure that we're getting everybody.
Okay. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ms. Schutt, what about orders that have already been issued? If the Supreme Court has put this in a footnote, it was dicta, and as you mentioned, there are thousands and thousands of orders out there. How are they impacted by this?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Taylor, how are they impacted by this? The statute itself doesn't have any kind of relating back or anything in clause that says it applies to orders that are currently in existence. It's our view, or my view in particular, that agency heads already have authority to delegate this, and I think that's a position that the Department of Justice is prepared to defend. But out of an abundance of caution, we really felt that we should clarify this going forward. In other words, this proposed legislation doesn't particularly address orders that are currently in existence.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Schutt, going back to something else you commented on, I would read this bill language as allowing a delegation not just to a named individual, but to an office or position. And that's often a useful thing whenever you're delegating authority, to be able to name not just the particular person who holds it, because then when you have sort of the normal turnover in a position, you're allowed then whoever gets that new that same title as the successor then automatically succeeds to the authorities that the prior person had, so you don't have to go through and redo all the delegations of authority just because of that turnover. Do you read it the same way I do?
Mr. Chairman, I was reading the last sentence, the delegation form must name the authorized officers or employee, and the officers or employees must acknowledge and sign the form. I was reading that to require them literally to name them, to specify them by name so that those named persons could then sign the form. I could see that an argument could be made that we could identify the office and then the office holder could sign the delegation form. I could see that, but that is not how I read that. Hence my comment it could be improved by making it more clear that the person, whoever it is that holds a particular position, could receive the delegation of authority.
Yeah, I take your point that if the bill requiring an acknowledgement by the officer or employee, that suggests that that individual has to acknowledge they have that authority. And if then they left their position and somebody else took on that same responsibility, that individual wouldn't have acknowledged.
Correct.
It does seem to me it could be improved by dropping the acknowledgement requirement, clarifying that can apply to an office or title. As long as it's in writing and it's in the agency's records, that would seem to be sufficient, because what I'm concerned about is that we may be making more cumbersome the operation of these delegations. And we might at the same time want to address this. I am troubled by the term officer. In a public setting, we have public safety officers, so the term is used in that way. But we don't have officers in the same way that corporate organizations do.
Mr. Chairman, I think I truly think that officer does scoop in those volunteer board members who sit, for example, on the Board of Medical Examiners or the other professional licensing boards. Those folks could not be considered employees of the agency, in my opinion. They would be officers, however, of the agency.
Okay, well, maybe that may be fine as it is. My inclination would be to work this a little further before we try to report it out. Any other questions or comments from the committee?
Good concerns.
Okay, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2122.
Thank you.
And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2124. We have Ronell Schenkel from the Department of Justice to present on House Bill 2124.
Chair McPherson, may I also bring up Tom Hedberg from the Division of Child Support at the same time?
Please.
If I may, for the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice. I am actually here today because the committee is new and starting this week, and I was going to give you the 3 minutes or less review of the Oregon Child Support Program and then introduce you to Tom Hedberg, who is actually our liaison and works directly on the Child Support Program, and he is distributing his testimony and will walk you through the bill. For those of you that aren't familiar with the Child Support Program, by statute it is the Attorney General who is designated with responsibility for the oversight of Oregon's Child Support Program. We started this program originally many, many years ago as a welfare recovery division program, very much focused on working those cases where children were receiving some sort of cash state assistance and getting reimbursement for the state. Over the years, as many of you are aware, that has dramatically changed, not only at the state level but at the national level. And the focus of child support programs today, while we still do provide recovery for state programs, the bigger emphasis is on serving families. And in fact, the distribution scheme has most of the money collected going directly to those families, and recovery for the state comes later in the process. The goal is to have families self-sufficient and both parents taking care of their children. The Oregon child support program has approximately 250,000 cases to date. This is not a means-tested program. Anyone can come into the child support program. Either the mother or the father can ask for services. Some families are referred automatically if their children are receiving some sort of state assistance through the Department of Human Services or when a child goes into juvenile care or foster care. The services provided by the program, and there's reams and reams of paper that describe all of this, but briefly, they locate missing parents, they establish support orders to include cash support and health insurance, they modify those orders throughout the years to make sure they stay in compliance and appropriate for the family. They provide accounting services on those orders, and the part you're probably most familiar with, they enforce the child support orders for the families of Oregon. They also do interstate casework and several other pieces, but I won't go into that level of detail today. One other thing that I might mention, or two other things briefly, the child support program in Oregon is actually made up of two parts. While the directorship of the program is a responsibility of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, and many of the centralized services are done in the Department of Justice Division of Child Support, in addition to those Division of Child Support offices located throughout the state, we also have 28 of the 36 county district attorneys that provide child support services to families. So this program has historically been a partnership between the Department of Justice and the county district attorneys and continues to be so. Oftentimes when Tom is before the committee, he will be speaking for the entire program and will have coordinated efforts with those other agencies. The last thing I'll mention, because of another bill that is up a little later, this is a federal program with specific mandates. We are required to have a qualified child support program in Oregon in order to get some funding. The child support program gets a federal match. Basically, for every dollar spent, we get $2 from the federal government. And if we do not maintain a qualified program, in addition to possibly losing our funding in the child support program, we can have an impact in Oregon on our temporary assistance to needy family grant. So the child support program and cooperation with the child support program is directly tied to the TANF and the work at Department of Human Services. So that is the really, really down and dirty 3-minute child support presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions. It's not your focus today, I know. But Tom will be in the building and available to answer questions throughout the session.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schenkel. So, and we need to hear more about the particulars of this bill. We'll be hearing that from Mr. Hedberg?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Hi, I'm Tom Hedberg. I am a manager with the Child Support Program for policy, legislation, and administrative rules. I'm here to speak in regards to House Bill 2124, which we kind of term, if you would allow me, a housekeeping bill. We have a few things that we wish to address that need some tweaking in the statute. The first one in Section 1 amends ORS 18790. This has to do with allowing the program to be... you have to excuse me here. I'm going to try my first time and getting over my anxieties about that. I was ready when the snow day happened, but it didn't work out too well that day. And I have to tell you, my family's really tired of hearing me talk about this. In our garnishments, when we request a data match with a financial institution, we must send a check every time we do that. Now, some financial institutions have been nice enough to allow us to be periodically billed. Other financial institutions have stuck to the letter of the statute and require that we send them a bill every time we do this. That's a cumbersome process. We would like to be, what the bill would do is amend the statute to allow us to be periodically billed and enter into agreements with all those financial institutions when we send for a data match to see if an obligated parent has some kind of monies or a resource that we could tap into if needed to enforce an order. This would help our process. They would just bill us periodically, and we would then pay the bill instead of having to process an individual check every time. As a matter of process, do you want, since we this bill includes a number of things, would you like to stop and ask questions on each one, or do we need to go through all of it first?
Well, the committee should feel free to ask specific questions about items that you address, but I think you ought to proceed through them all until we have questions come up.
Okay, thank you. Section 2 of the bill, we have multiple orders that are entered for different reasons. Sometimes they're interstate. This pertains mainly to bills that are entered or orders that are entered in the state of Oregon, and it has to do with the issue that on occasions we will be the child support division primarily works in administrative process, so they would be entering a order that is administratively based. At the same time, that doesn't preclude that there would be a judicial action going or pending, dealing with issues that the administrative process does not deal with, you know, divorce, child custody issues, those kinds of things. So they could be paralleling. Quite often, the administrative process is finished and finalized before the judicial action is. We have run into some issues of having to initiate secondary legal actions because the administrative order would be entered first, and then subsequently the judicial order would be entered. And in statute it says that that order would become effective the date it was entered onto the docket. Quite often these judicial orders began or would have an effective date far back from that date or during the time that we would have entered the administrative order. So you have actually two orders that would be technically billing at the same period of time. We have a process to deal with that, but we would like to avoid having to do these legal actions in reconciling those arrears to decide what's billed in what month. And what we would like to do is change the statute, and in statute, rather than say the judgment is entered, say that it would be the effective date of the judgment. So that would be the beginning pay date of that money award. Section 3 is a site change that was recommended by legal counsel when we asked them to draft this bill. And I don't have a lot of information as to the why. It was a cleanup thing left over from prior sessions. Section 4 would change the wording in ORS 25411. And this is our withholding statute. And what we have is some confusion about a five-day window that we allow in the statute. Generally, we'll send a withholding order to an employer. There's 5 days that they are allowed to get things processed. If it's, for example, their next pay period is within 2 days, we're allowed to take 5 days and wait until the pay period after that. Some employers have translated this to mean, because of the wording is such, that they actually have to wait 5 days after their first pay period. And this has, in cases where, for example, an employer pays on a monthly basis, this extends that pay period out to the next month, and the payment is not forthcoming in a real timely manner. We would like to clarify the statute and language in the statute to make sure that the employers understand that they're allowed 5 days to get the withholding process for the employee, and if they don't have 5 days, they're allowed to wait to the next pay period, rather than they just skip the first pay period and then go from that point. Section 5 would add language and...
Mr. Chair, I'll ask a question about that section.
Please.
Thank you, Thomas. You're doing a great job. We'll tell your family.
Thank you.
I just have a question about that particular... You mentioned a monthly payroll. What about a company who's paid weekly, biweekly, twice a month? So if... A payroll is typically, let's say their payroll ends on a Saturday,
mm-hmm.
And they process that on Sunday. They put all the information in on a Sunday. They get a notice on Monday, and the payday is not until the next Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
Chairman Pierce and Representative Cameron, you know, that's a short time frame. I would suspect that if they feel they have the 5 days to put the process in and meet that next pay period, that would be great. If not, the subsequent pay period would be fine. So in that scenario, if it was processed on Monday and they their next pay would be that next weekend, they would have their 5 days to get everything in order.
Well, I want to be clear. Is it 5 days before payday? Okay, in the scenario that I just... described, that employer would be in violation of not withholding that if they can't go back and change that payroll because they got it on Monday, payday is on Friday.
Chair McPherson,
now, a lot of companies do their payroll that far in advance.
Are you asking whether or not the payroll that they already ran before they got the income withholding would need to be adjusted, or are you asking about the upcoming weekend payroll?
Payday is this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
but they ran their payroll on the Friday before or the Saturday before, you know, a 7-day window. But the notice shows up after I've run that payroll, but 5 days before I actually pay the employee. Because the old wording was a lot easier. It was a lot easier to follow in that circumstance. But this wording says I must do it if I receive it by 5 days. So that's going to be a complication for some employers, and I wonder what the consequences are.
Monday, Tuesday, Monday. Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I think the emphasis is still the first payday following receipt of the order. And then, depending on when that next pay period cuts off, which I think in your scenario it was Saturday, correct?
First payday after receipt of the order. I received the order on Monday. The payday is Friday.
Correct.
The way it's worded is I must withhold that child support now.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, I believe so for that upcoming pay period, correct?
Not for the one.
And Chairman McPherson and Representative Cameron, I believe if the process was done on Sunday for the when you're going to pay the employee on Monday, or I mean on Friday, is that the scenario? Then I would believe that you would not have to do any withholding on that Friday paycheck that you would be issuing on Friday, but the subsequent one you would, yes. Because you've already processed it before. If you decided what that employer was going to be paid on the Sunday prior to getting the withholding, then that is not required.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry for not acknowledging.
Please,
yeah, but the way this is worded, it says payday, which is Friday, not pay processing. And so as an employer, I want to know what those consequences are. The employer is going to not, you know, he's going to have to make a decision or she's going to have to make a decision. Do I rerun this paycheck?
Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, I hear you making a clarification, and perhaps we could look at that and work with you on the difference between
okay.
the literal payday versus the processing of the payroll. If you would allow us a chance to look at our federal regulation, we'd be happy to circle back and see if perhaps we can clarify that language even further.
Thank you.
I think our intent meets what you are hoping we will do, but I hear that the language may not be clear yet.
Mr. Chair, one more question. Kind of, is there compensation for the employer for withholding for doing this?
Under Chairman McPherson and Representative Cameron, under the statute, the employer is allowed to charge the employee $5
okay.
per pay period, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I want to follow up on the line of questioning that Representative Cameron was on, because it is a change in the language, but I think it's not an intended change in the substance as to, because it both before and after it refers to a 5-day period. And so that essentially, if you receive an order requiring withholding of child support within 5 days before a payday, you don't have to withhold from that paycheck. But if more than 5 days, if in a situation when some employers have this where it takes them more than 5 days to process, that is that they may have closed off at mid-month, some employers that have a January 15 payroll won't, for a half month, won't actually deliver that check until 7, 8, 9 days after that. And in that situation, I think both before and after, it would require the withholding to apply, even though the pay period had closed. There's no intent to change that substance, right?
Chair McPherson, I believe that is correct. I think you are understanding it the way we're intending it. I don't know whether or not the language is clear.
So I guess it seems sufficiently clear to me that that's still the result, but it is said in a different way. That is, the new language would be, however, if the withholder receives the order to withhold less than 5 days before the first payday following receipt of the order, withholder shall start withholding not later than the second payday following receipt of the order.
Chair McPherson, the bottom line is that we don't want to put a burden on our employers. They are an important partner, and in fact, the primary way that we collect most child support in Oregon, as you're aware. However, because of the literal reading of the current statute by some employers' attorneys, they believe that they basically have a window and an extra 5 days that they can purposely hold and not send in their child support, and that's a small group that we're trying to clarify. You should process within this window if you receive it in time to do so. We're not intending to change overall the way this works, and in fact, for most employers, it is working. But for some with multiple pay periods, they believe this gives them the ability to basically miss one pay period and wait for the following one, and that's what we're trying to avoid.
Representative Cameron, are you satisfied with the clarity of this last sentence that's being added here? I want to make sure people are. I'm just trying to figure out how we would say it differently to get to make it clear that if your payday comes within 5 days after the order is first in hand, you don't have to respond, but the next payday you do.
Can you repeat what you just said? I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, the rule I see set out in the new language is that there's a payday. And if within the 5 days before that you get an order in, you don't have to comply as to that payday.
I agree. That's correct. That's what this says.
Yeah, and that it seems sufficiently clear to me. But I just want to make sure people are satisfied with it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's clear to me, and that's my point. Is that if I receive it, I've already processed my payroll, and you described. I know a company here in town that pays on. I don't know, on like the 15th and the 27th, or I don't know what or 10th and the 27th. That 10th is for the payroll that's been accrued by the end of the month.
Right.
See what I'm saying? They're running that payroll sometime within that 10 days and probably before that 5 days. So now I get a notice to withhold $200 and some odd from somebody's paycheck. I've got that check in the pipe someplace.
Right. And the only way to solve that is by extending beyond 5 days the amount of advance notice you have to have, which would be a substantive change from where the statute was before. So that's the policy choice. Should we be extending the notice period because some employers have a longer pipeline for delivering their checks?
That'd be a good question. Should we extend it?
Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee. Ms. Shankle, let me ask you a couple of questions here. I assume the term receive, it means that the letter that you send out, and I assume you send it by letter, is it correct?
Chair McPherson and Mr. Taylor, it is actually an income withholding order that is sent by regular mail.
By regular mail. So receive would be when it arrives in the principal place of business. Am I correct?
Chair McPherson and Mr. Taylor, yes.
Mr. Chairman, of the committee, a couple of other questions, if I could. So if the business, if it arrives at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Monday, I assume that a day would be from 4 o'clock on Monday to 4 o'clock on Tuesday?
Chair McPherson and Mr. Taylor, I don't know that we would hold them to that level of detail. I believe we count business days in general.
So
we
you
would
start
presume
counting
they
on
received
Tuesday
it
then,
Monday.
Probably?
Correct. The count would begin the next day.
So the day of receipt in many wouldn't count. So, as far as your account goes.
Chair McPherson and Mr. Taylor, I was looking to see what our exact language is. I don't know the answer to that specifically, and I don't know if 5 days, should we bring up our general counsel to the child support program? Would that be helpful? Do you want to spend more time on this?
I guess the question of how we count the days, it seems less important to me than the question of whether 5 days is the right period, which is really the question that's been raised, is should we be changing it to something different from 5 days? And
10 days.
And so I guess the question is, maybe pose the first question is this 5-day period something that we're boxed in by federal law on, or is it something that the state could make it could go differently from other?
Chair McPherson, looking back to our council, that is a policy choice for the state with regard to the timing.
Okay, yeah.
Make
okay.
It 10 days.
Well, I guess, and that, and what it does seem to me that may impede the ability to collect. if we were to extend that time. And so it's not something we necessarily do lightly, because some employers want to queue things up and get it through a pipeline. What, any reactions to the idea of extending that time?
Chair McPherson, you're correct. We were not hoping to have the emphasis be on the time period. As I mentioned before, the 5 days is working for the majority of employers. I think if we looked back historically, the 5 days sort of assumed that for those weekly pay periods, you were catching most people for the upcoming week. If we go to 10 days, we're going to have a much more significant impact and be making more of a policy choice than was intended in a housekeeping bill. We were hoping to clarify for those employers that have the more complicated payroll, as Representative Cameron was explaining, to clarify it for them. I presume we'd rather leave it alone and have the majority of our employers continue to do the 5 days rather than having that policy discussion.
Right.
Of course we defer to the committee, but we would be going beyond housekeeping at that point and making a significant change.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. It's a comment on this issue. As a single mother that's gone through divorce, I didn't have to go to this level, but I have many, many peers that did. When you haven't paid your electric bill and your phone bill, and you haven't, I mean, literally, when you have to move out the washing machine to see if there's loose change to buy a loaf of bread, 5 days, an additional 5 days, is a horrific amount of time. And right now, I mean, if somebody's going through this process, it's already not pretty. And to extend that longer for the recipient is, I would really have a problem with
Mr. Chair, can I clarify?
This wouldn't, Cameron.
The extension, Representative Kump, the extension would not change the payday or the processes to which the recipient would get the money. This is just... I'm just bringing up an issue of an employer that has a process in place that doesn't fit with this time frame. I'm not saying everybody does it, and I know as an employer we work really hard to follow the letter of the law.
Right.
And if I have to follow the letter of the law, what this says is I have to redo my payroll for this particular person or persons, and we'll get one or two of these a month, and 100 employees will get one or two of these judgments in our small business. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure that the employers that do want to follow the letter of the law, that we don't make this really inconvenient for them. And yes, we do want to take care of those people that are deserving this money. So that's my point in this.
Chair McPherson, that is our intent. We do not want employers to have to recalculate their payroll. We simply want them to be certain to apply this order during the next payroll, and that apparently has not been clear with the existing language in some of the scenarios.
Okay. We still have Section 5 of the bill to talk about. So if there are any more questions, no more questions on Section 4. It's good to understand what it is we have before us. Let's hear about Section
4. On Section 4, could we change the word instead of payday to whatever the process, I don't know what word you'd use, so the employer processing it would affect that. If they've already processed it, they'd get to go to the next one. Because as Representative Cameron's pointing out, the payday, the actual process is done a week earlier, then your 5 days kind of screws that up. But if we were able to have it talk about within 5 days before the first,
payroll calculation.
Let's continue with the hearing to get all the input, and then I think we'll probably take this to work session to kick it around and see where we want to go. Mr. Hedberg.
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee. Section 5 would add language to 418.135. To allow the Division of Child Support and the Department of Human Services to share information when an application for services is made to the Department of Human Services. Currently, the statute reads when a child is receiving services, but federal statutes allow and expect that the Division of Child Support and the Department of Human Services would be cooperating and reviewing and sharing information upon an application for service. And we just need that correction in the statute to allow us to do what we do in practice, in fact. and our confidentiality rules and statutes all meet that requirement at this point to allow us to do that.
Any questions about that or any of the other sections of the bill that we can ask of our witnesses before we take this into discussion? Okay, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2124. I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2124 so we can discuss where to head on this. Committee, here's how I see it. We have a housekeeping bill here. It's got a number of elements to it that need to be attended to update and bring forward the program. One of those housekeeping changes, which is it was intended purely as a clarification about the counting of the 5 days rule, has now been questioned as to whether that's the right policy. That is, should we have a longer time measured from the pay date, or I suppose another way you could do it is you could measure it from the close of the pay period, which is when the processing starts. But bear in mind, that is going to have an impact, or may have an impact, on the amount that is realized by this program for the benefit of families that are depending on the flow of dollars. So we shouldn't necessarily so lightly decide that we should be extending that time, either measured from the pay date, or take a different measuring date. And I'm just guessing about this, but I would imagine that probably the department would rather have the whole housekeeping bill fail than to have a significant policy choice like that go forward. And it may be that that's a bill for another day if there's a sense among employers that they need to have that time measured differently. And we haven't received any input from employers telling us, coming in and presenting to us and telling us that they need that change. So I'd like to open it for discussion to see what reactions the committee has to this.
Mr. Chair, I'll suggest, maybe make a suggestion. I think that it can be worked out. Some things we need to consider, maybe we just pull off a little sub-work group and think through this thing, because you have monthly payrolls, you have, you know, twice a month payrolls, and the real critical thing here for a single parent, in my mind, when I look at this, is if somebody's on a monthly payroll, and as the department says, I interpret this that I got this 5 days before, and I blow it off as an employer, the employer blows it off, that employee accrues all that payroll, and meanwhile, as Representative Comp says, that mother or father who's due that waits another 60 days to get that compensation that they're due. So I understand the 30 days are a real critical period, and maybe we have a shorter time for the 30 day. I mean, there's some ways you could look at this and determine it, but I just think that for the people who want to do this right and have a broader window than 5 days when they run their payroll, we ought to take a look at it.
Other thoughts?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would be interested in hearing the extent of the concern, and I know Representative Cameron brought it up, but if we're talking about just a few employers who are having a problem once they get the notification that they need to withhold, if it's just a handful, then maybe there's a way to deal with it that doesn't involve a substantive change. So I think we need more information about the extent of the problem, and I know Ms. Jenkel said that it is just the exception rather than the rule that employers are having a problem with this. So I think we need some more information.
Anyone else?
Concur.
Okay. Well, I think what we need to do is to not take action on the bill today. We'll consider then what possible, whether this is the appropriate vehicle to consider changes that might accommodate concerns by employers. Mm-hmm. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2124. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2139. Mike Niemeyer from Department of Justice.
Good
Good morning, Chair McPherson, committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Niemeyer. I'm the Alternative Dispute Resolution Coordinator for the Department of Justice, and I'm here to speak to you briefly in support of HB 2139. This bill lies at the intersection of two important policies for Oregon government. One is the policy of open government, open records and open meetings that allows the public to participate in the deliberations of government. And the other important policy, longstanding policy, is in support of alternative forms of dispute resolution, collaborative dispute resolution, and mediation. This particular bill clarifies language related to mediation confidentiality in workplace interpersonal disputes involving public bodies. It is a fairly straightforward, simple bill, but the underlying law is not so simple and straightforward. Mediation confidentiality is a little complicated, and to give you the two-minute version of this, the legislature in 1997 did a major rewrite of the mediation confidentiality statutes, and in doing that, they attempted to balance those two interests, the one in open government and the interest in promoting mediation. And the way that they did that was to provide a different structure depending on who was participating in the mediation process. So for most mediations, so for example, the barking dog dispute that a community program might mediate, there's a presumption that that mediation is confidential. For mediations in which public bodies are involved, and in particular state agencies, the presumption is just the opposite, that if a state agency, for example, is involved in a mediation process and a private party's also party to that, the presumption is that that's not confidential unless that agency has jumped through a couple hoops, one of which is the adoption of rules that are promulgated by the Attorney General. And the purpose of that, again, was to ensure that mediation wasn't used as an opportunity to do an end run around open government laws. This bill seeks a clarification by providing an exception in ORS 36228, and that particular statute provides that if the only parties to a mediation are public bodies, then that mediation cannot be confidential. And again, you know, it's the public's business. If we just have public bodies in a room and they're trying to resolve a dispute, the public should have access to that information, and that's the public policy there. The exception to it, though, is for workplace interpersonal disputes, there's been a longstanding policy of support for mediation of workplace interpersonal disputes in public bodies. And this is evidenced most recently in the 2005 legislative session, where the department sought changes to the law to support a program, a pilot project that we created, which shares employees between agencies to provide free mediation. And the way this program works is we might borrow somebody from ODOT to go help resolve a workplace dispute over at DHS, for example. And so there's no cost to the agencies. The ODOT employee gets some training and experience mediating. The DHS folks get their dispute resolved. The legislature supported that policy, and that was HB 2205, which is now codified in 183.502(9). So, again, what we're seeking here is just a clarification that the confidentiality of these workplace disputes involving public bodies is an exception and not in conflict with the policy that prohibits confidentiality of mediations that only involve public bodies. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Niemeyer? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Niemeyer, so to be perfectly clear, we're talking specifically about interpersonal relationships, employees within agencies, and any personal disputes that have arisen in the workplace. Individual employee to individual employee matters, and those dispute resolutions would remain confidential.
Chair McPherson and Representative Flores. That's right. So it uses the term workplace interpersonal disputes. So these are disputes between employees within an agency. In terms of what exactly would remain confidential, the agency and the parties have the ability to provide greater disclosure. The law and the rules available from the Attorney General also provide some exceptions. So not everything is able to be kept confidential, but most things are. So the idea is that if those employees need to have a candid discussion and talk about their problems, that they can do that, that there is some ability to have that candid discussion with some exceptions.
Yes, you may.
Is this a huge problem across agencies, interpersonal disputes that need to be resolved through these types of mediation?
Well, it's state government, which I'm most familiar with, is like any large employer, and certainly there are disputes in the workplace. I've worked in private and nonprofit sectors. I don't think there's any more workplace interpersonal disputes in state government than other places, but like any large employer, these things happen. And as you probably imagine, it has a huge hit on productivity. So if employees are fighting in a work group, that affects the productivity of everyone in that section. Mediation is not a substitute for good management. We do a lot of triage and oftentimes recommend agencies don't use mediation in certain cases. But oftentimes it is a good resource to help sort out those problems.
Any other questions,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I saw this, too, I had a couple of concerns about the same thing that Representative Flores, about how big a problem it is. And are we talking here supervisor, employee? Are they equal status? I don't see why this is an issue, I guess is my question to you, sir.
Representative Wisnett and Chair McPherson, this doesn't specify, so it could certainly involve a supervisor-subordinate relationship in the workplace. In terms of how big the problem is, in terms of quantitating that, I deal with 30 or 40 myself disputes, probably a year. Where I'm called in and asked to help agencies, and that I would say is probably the tip of the iceberg in terms of what they're dealing with. In terms of agencies, have other resources to go to do this type of mediation. But when those do happen, they can have a fairly significant impact in the workplace. And mediation oftentimes is very successful at unwinding those disputes. But I wouldn't overstate it. I mean, this is. It is not a huge problem. Yeah.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Unless there are other witnesses to come forward on this, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2139 and open a work session on House Bill 2139. Any discussion before I invite a motion on this bill? And do I have a motion to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
I'll so move.
Motion's been made by Representative Barker that we move House Bill 2139 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of that motion? Hearing none, then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici? Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Cox? Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Excused.
Representative Vice Chair Parker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
And Chair McPherson?
Aye.
And since you were the first aye vote, Representative Bonamici, would you carry that bill on the floor?
If you would like me to, I will.
That's a good theory. You're going to be carrying a lot of money. She goes alphabetical.
Close the work session on House Bill 2139.
I'll load you up.
And open a public hearing on House Bill 2125. We have Audrey Hirsch from the DOJ Family Law Section. Ms. Hirsch? Very good. Mr. Hedberg, yeah, please come forward as well.
I'll actually defer to him to begin. I'll introduce myself. My name is Audrey Hirsch. I'm general counsel to Child Support, and I work in the DOJ Family Law Section.
Please start out by whichever one wants to lead off. Identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you.
Chairman McPherson, my name is Thomas Hedberg, and I'm with the Department of Justice Division of Child Support. I am here to speak on House Bill 2125. This bill comes to us because of some changes in federal law. The Deficit Reduction Act of 2005 was passed by Congress and signed by the President. And in that law, there were provisions that changed how child support would calculate medical insurance and proceed to add it to its calculations and determine who should be responsible to provide that coverage for children. There were also other pieces within the Deficit Reduction Act that changed our processes, and those are addressed in here, and I'll as I talk about each section, we'll clarify those. Excuse me. The first one in Section 1 has to do with modification. There are two ways that we modify orders, or orders come up for modification. One of them is that there's a review period currently in the state of Oregon that is in 2 years that you're entitled to have your child support obligation reviewed every 2 years, if you wish, at the request of either of the parties. The other one is the change of circumstances, that something has happened that has affected the ability of either the person that's obligated to pay or the situation has changed in regards to the child that requires a review of the order, that in fact there may be some special needs or some other circumstance. What the federal government has requested and is prompting our change is that they have mandated in the Deficit Reduction Act that the child support programs review any child support order every 3 years when there is a TANF program. So any child receiving TANF benefits, their order needed to be reviewed every 3 years, and that's a mandated service that we're expected to provide. Because we currently have a 2-year review period, mm-hmm. in order to create some consistency within the program so that we're not doing two different things, we would request, and what we're looking to change and help with us is that we move to a three-year review period so that we can keep our process consistent throughout the modification. Section 2 of our bill allows the department to have some flexibility in regards to one of the other mandates from the Deficit Reduction Act is that the program charged $25 annual fee on all cases where the program has received $500 within a calendar year, and that calendar year has not been defined by the federal government as yet. And the family has never received any benefits from TANF from the state. So they would have to have never received any benefits, and they would have to receive $500 within a year, and at that point they would owe a $25 fee to the program, of which the federal government would take a 2/3 share. And that is figured into the current federal budget as a means to reduce the cost to the federal government and for the services that are provided by the state that the federal government funds.
Mr. Hedberg, if I could break in, the who pays the fee, the existing one and this new fee?
One of the issues, a policy decision that has not been made yet, is who should pay that fee. The federal government, at this point, has not made a definitive policy statement, but they have said that they will probably leave that up to the states to decide who should pay the fee. The choice that the program has is either to charge the obligated parent or to charge the obligee in some way, through the payment, just take $25 out of the next payment. Or the other option that the federal government has said is if you do not charge either one of the parties, that the state then must pay that fee. So the state would be responsible.
The federal legislation leaves it as a choice to the state.
So who does the fee go to? Does it go to the federal government then?
Yes.
2/3 of it goes to the federal government.
I see. So if the state picked up that cost, then as to a third of it, it's sort of just cycling dollars within the state system. But the 2/3 that goes to the federal government is out of pocket to somebody, into the state, or if the state could recover it from the parties, either the obligated parent or the receiving parent, then it would come out of them or split between them.
Yes.
Has there been any decision made about as to this new fee? What happens to the existing fee that's discharged?
Our Chairman McPherson, at this point in time, there's a $1 annual fee, and that, as again, goes into the program. The program at this point is looking to discontinue that fee and just deal with this $25 fee.
Okay, so this fee, has there been any decision made about how the state will handle that fee?
The program at this point looks like the best way to do it in our system to be able to do it in an automated way would be to take the first $25 paid after the initial $500 from what would have been owed to the child and use that as the fee.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron.
So this fee is mandated by the federal government, and just so I can put this in practical terms, these are people who have failed to work out a relationship with their previous spouses to pay their monthly child support, and it's defaulted to this program where we deduct it from their payroll checks and those types of things. Is that pretty simplified way of saying what we're talking about here?
Representative, or Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, or people that have applied for the services from the program, they can make application to do this voluntarily to have this accounted through the state, and these would be cases where no public assistance has ever been expended, so the state would have never paid to take care of the children in that regard.
Okay, so if we, and I'm just going to speak hypothetically, so if we applied this fee to the person who's obligated to pay the child support, if we said we're going to charge you this fee, if I was one of those people, I'd also have the option, if I wanted to just work out an agreement with my ex-wife to pay child support and avoid the $25 fee. Would that be accurate? Most cases?
Chairman McPherson and Representative Cameron, sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, you could work that out privately and not pay through the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Then proceed through the bill then, Mr. Okay. Hedberg.
In Section 3, this has to do with health coverage. Currently in our statute and in our guidelines, we define health coverage as reasonable and convenient to the child as being through the employer. What has been found over research and time is that there is less health insurance available through employers, and that the expense of that health insurance that is available through employers has climbed and has increased in its cost. Many employers are then dropping it. So our definition and the federal definition of reasonable in cost and how that service is provided has changed. And what the federal government in the Deficit Reduction Act has said is because of this, there needed to be an ability to first redefine medical insurance in a different manner, that reasonable and just defined as being from an employer does not meet what's currently happening in our society, that it needs to be defined as either party should be able to obtain it, because what is found and in research is that, you know, probably the most effective insurance is provided by the custodial parent because they know the needs of the child better than the non-custodial sometimes, though that's not always true, but one of the most effective means of working that out is that's the person who has custody. They are able to work out whatever needs to be worked out with the insurance companies in a much more efficient manner necessarily than working through a third party to get those needs met. So what the federal government has asked is that states redefine health insurance and what's reasonable, and also to, yeah. Oh, did I? I'm sorry. I was, I guess I said Section 3, and I'm sorry, I'm on Section 5. Correct myself. So what we would like to do is in there's another piece going on at the moment. The federal government requires that the child support guidelines, which are the calculations used to figure out what the child support obligation should be, must be reviewed every 4 years, and the state of Oregon is currently in that review. We have had, in fact, to delay the finalization of the guideline review because of these current regulations that have just come to us. The proposed rulemaking at the federal level just came out in late October, so we have been reviewing that and trying to figure out how we would do this in redefining and what the requirements would be. So we would like to go back into our guidelines and reactivate that committee and have them then add this to what we have reviewed in the calculation of guidelines and have this be put into our guidelines. That we would there define medical insurance as being available and I'm sorry, I'm losing this word and I don't know why it's escaped my head.
Cash medical.
No, the word of convenience. Accessible. I'm sorry, that was the word I couldn't remember. Being accessible, and that we would order medical support from either party, from either the custodial parent or the non-custodial parent, whichever had the access. There would be in the process of determining the child support amount, there would be a determination of how best that should be handled, and that through that process, if there was not an employer insurance, so we would use that if it was available, that we would order the custodial parent to provide that insurance if it was available to them, and that the non-custodial parent could either pay a cash medical premium to the custodial parent that would be used to provide that insurance to the child. In that also, what the Deficit Reduction Act asked was that cash medical could also be used to reimburse the state if the child was receiving state medical assistance of some kind. So if the child, for example, was on Oregon Health Plan, the cash medical could be ordered against the obligated parent, and then that piece could be sent to the state to reimburse the state for what is paying out for the plan. This is a very big change in policy at the federal level.
Mr. Hedberg, so under current law, there's no ability of the state to recover from the non-custodial parent, or maybe from either of the parents, the cost of coverage under the Oregon Health Plan provided to the child?
Chairman McPherson, yes, that's true. No, there is not.
Okay.
At this point in time, our focus has been to obtain whether there is employer-related health care coverage and then ordering that obligated parent to provide it, even if the child is receiving Oregon Health Plan, and that is not reimbursable at this time.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Krieger.
If there is a court order that required the non-custodial parent as part of the court or the settlement or whatever you might want to call it to provide insurance and they don't, how do you get involved in that and how would you know if you don't review it but every 3 years unless there was a complaint or something?
Chairman McPherson and Representative Krieger, that's one of those issues we're trying to work out right now because our system is geared to enforce against an obligated parent, not against a custodial parent. And one of the things we're looking at is one, our system doesn't allow it at this point for us to initiate any kind of order of enforcement, but also in what the federal final requirements will be, it may be advantageous for us to meet their benchmarks that we would have to enforce against the custodial parent, and we would have to figure out a way to send an order to the health insurance provider that the custodial parent has to maintain that so that so the children are covered. I don't know if I said that as well as I should.
If I may clarify, Chair McPherson.
Please.
I think the question was directed at enforcement, and it's actually separate from the modification that would be every 3 years. This is really a completely separate part of the agency, which is the enforcement remedies. We're really not changing existing statutory enforcement remedies, which include the National Medical Support Notice. We have the statutory authority currently to issue that to the obligated parents employer. So that is independent of any three-year review. We're constantly getting that information from employers and updating, you know, enforcement remedies. This would just add that same enforcement remedy against the custodial parent. Just it's more of a focus on making sure that the insurance is provided in a variety of ways rather than the existing enforcement against just the obligated parent.
And Chairman Pearson and Representative Krieger, if I may add, the federal government is attempting to assist states by developing a database that would show all insurance companies would report to saying that this insurance is available, and then when and share that information with the states, and the states then would issue the notice of to provide health insurance. And we're trying to work out the details of that.
Just to make sure we've got an adequate record, Ms. Hirsch, could you identify yourself for the record?
I apologize, I did that early, but my name is Audrey Hirsch. I'm from DOJ Family Law Section, and I represent Child Support as their general counsel.
Very good. Representative Cameron, did you have a question?
No, I do.
Okay, Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I really like what this is attempting to do. I would just want to ask a little deeper question, and that is, once you have this information, will you be, if people don't have the means to have regular insurance through your employer and all this other stuff, are you going to be letting people know about the Oregon Health Plan? It was my awareness last session on Revenue Committee that our state sent millions of dollars back to the federal government that could have gone for somebody's children for care. And hopefully this will cover a big gap in our system. But I don't know how you're going to proceed if the child has no health care but they're below the poverty level.
Representative McPherson, Chairman, Chairman McPherson, Representative Kump. At this point, there isn't an agreement with the Department of Human Services on us proceeding on that. We are aware and are following what the governor is doing in regards to his Healthy Kids Initiative and trying to make sure that all children are covered with health care, and if we can somehow connect with that, we will do so. So that ordering the obligated parent to pay cash medical that might be used to pay the premium or whatever that might work out on the healthy kids would be just fine with us and would be a solution to the situation where neither parent has health care coverage. But the best we could do at that point would be ordering cash medical order against the obligated parent, which the obligee would then have the discretion to use as they see fit to provide health care for the child.
Follow up.
Yes, ma'am.
I like the idea also of the database because if you have it in the database, then these other, human services could access it and do their own process, which I really appreciate.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Krieger.
You got parents with children, low income, living together. They're not required to have insurance. They may qualify for some program and be taking advantage of it or not, but those same people get separated, then we mandate coverage. Is that what you're telling me? This is what this does underneath the federal law?
Representative McPherson and our Chairman McPherson, Representative Krueger, the federal government requires that every child support order have a provision for medical insurance. So if services are requested through the program and the program issues an order, it must have a provision that deals with this issue of medical insurance.
Yes, sir. Council Taylor.
Chairman of the Committee, if I'm correct, child support orders are based on the person's ability to pay them. Is that correct?
Chairman McPherson, Council Taylor, yes, they are.
So if the parent had absolutely no money, say they were injured or something like that, there would be in at the time that the child support order was set, there wouldn't be a child support order.
Chairman McPherson and Mr. Taylor, the circumstances should be reviewed in each case as to what the situation is. There are obligated parents who have orders for no support because of their situation. They are disabled or they have no means to pay. Some have a much lesser reduced support obligation because there's some rebuttable presumption that they have a less ability to pay because of their circumstance.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but now I'm thoroughly confused. I appreciate your question, Mr. Taylor, but Section 5 seems to indicate, so I perhaps need to be walked through this a little bit, that in all child support orders entered under this chapter, moving ahead, either party or both parties provide satisfactory health coverage for the child, and the court finds if parties cannot provide health care coverage, then the court can order the obligor to pay cash medical support. So regardless of means to provide child support, they are required to make a cash contribution toward medical coverage, and it doesn't seem to be optional.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Flores, I read the bill. When I went through the bill, the way I read that is that currently, if you have health insurance or are able to have health insurance, you're covered. I think the group they're aiming at are those who can't afford health care insurance but can't afford to pay something. Is that correct?
Chairman McPherson, Mr. Taylor, yes, that is correct.
And that would be distinguished from someone who couldn't afford anything.
Yes.
I'm not seeing the distinction between those two groups, the ones who can pay a little something and the ones who can afford to pay nothing. By virtue of that order, the obligor to pay cash medical support, which may include paying cash for benefits provided by Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan. It seems to be a requirement to me, so that's why I'm just confused. I just need to see where that mechanism is there.
Chairman, as the committee, Representative Flores, I read the bill, but I didn't write it. And it may be best for the agency to explain that.
Mr. Hedberg?
Chairman McPherson, yes, we are already aware in our conversations with the legal aid that there needs to be some clarification, and we would offer an amendment to make that clear. And the other part is that we would like to do this calculation within the guidelines, the child support guidelines, and in that where we recognize there would probably have to be provisions to deal with situations where there's an inability to pay and that there may be a cap at the bottom of this level as well as a top cap of the amount of expense that would have to be provided in an employer-provided insurance. That's gotten so high that it has to be capped at some point, and that there are obligated parents or potential obligated parents who do not have the ability to pay support and thus probably should not be obligated to pay cash medical unless that there's a review that they have some ability to pay something to it. The other part that's also within the federal rulemaking is that there can be a determination made that to forego child support and just order the cash medical if that is in the best interest of the child.
Okay, any further questions for...
Mr. Chair, I have a quick question. Under Section 6, who's responsible for medical bills that remain after insurance coverage? If there is insurance coverage, but there's still remaining medical bills, who's responsible for those?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Bonamici. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Good. Thank you. Yeah. I was worrying about how I was going to say that today. one of the things that the federal government has taken into consideration in their medical work groups is that the states in their determination of what cash medical should be should also take into consideration those costs that might be incurred by the custodial parent. And in that, if they can make an allowance in some way, shape, or form that's a recurring cost that can be considered, then it should be considered in the cash medical award. I'm sorry. Yeah, against either or both of the parents.
Thank you.
Representative Cuff.
Just a clarifying question. Thank you, Chair McPherson. On the first section where the federal government is saying these situations need to be reviewed every 3 years. Is it still an option for either a parent to ask for a review in 2 years rather than 3?
Chair McPherson and Representative Kalm. They can if there's a change of circumstances. So
that still stays the same.
Yeah, the change of circumstances.
Right. Okay, because I wouldn't want to create a hardship if somebody was employed, now they're not employed, you know, how are they going to pay child support?
Yeah, if the regular review period we would hope would be 3 years, but if there was some change or something that would happen, they still have the ability to request that it be reviewed, and there would be a review and determination of if should the order be modified.
Yep, thank you for that clarification.
Okay, if there are no further questions, why don't we excuse these witnesses and hear from Sybil Hebb.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm a legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center, which is a civil legal assistance provider to low-income people across the state. I will not try to pass myself off as an administrative law expert to you today. Ordinarily, in matters related to the implementation of federal law in the child support program, I would have our administrative law expert, Karen Berkowitz, here today. She was still iced in this morning where she lives, so she wasn't able to be here. She has submitted written testimony, and I want to just provide a brief summary of what our concerns were, which I think the committee members have largely identified in their questions earlier today. So I'll be very brief and then would be happy to answer any follow-up questions or get more information from Karen for you and get back to you. We are generally supportive, of course, of the agency's need to implement federal law and believe very strongly that the agency is enforcement of child support and establishment is an incredibly necessary benefit for our clients. So we appreciate that. We have been in conversation with Audrey and with Mr. Hedberg and with Ms. Hirsch about some amendments to the bill that we would like to see to change a few of the specifics as it's currently written. And I'll summarize those briefly. Principally, we want to make sure that medical support awards, when they're made, are determined according to the child support guidelines so that the children's needs are taken into consideration, but also the parties' abilities to pay are taken into consideration. And we think that can be effectively done by making some provisions in the statute and also in the guidelines. So we're in further conversation about that. The other concern that we had is wanting to make sure that medical costs that were not covered by insurance are also appropriately apportioned between the parties. And again, as Mr. Hedberg reflected, we've been in discussion about that issue. The only other thing that I wanted to mention that hasn't been discussed yet is the fact that we want to be careful that any additional award of medical support to an obligee who's caring for a child not be something that would then cause that child to be ineligible for the Oregon Health Plan if that would be detrimental to that child's ability to maintain health coverage. And I think that's, again, something that could be addressed by making sure that the guidelines take that into consideration. And just to give you an example, in general, if a child is disabled and may have significant medical costs such that coverage under the Oregon Health Plan is a major benefit and really helps to provide continued care and health for the child, then we wouldn't want the addition of, you know, $25 extra in medical support to lose that benefit to the child. And so, I think that can be taken into account in the guidelines. And I think that's the general summary of our concerns. We had a few other suggestions in terms of the language and consistency of definitions, but I think we're in conversation about that and can address those in amendments that will be brought back to the committee. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Cameron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sybil, do you have any opinions on Section 2 about the $25 fee and where that should be, where it should come from?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, thank you for asking. I had noted to myself that I wanted to bring that up, and yes, we would agree that we would hope that that would be taken into consideration and apportioned appropriately given the circumstances of the family and the parents. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Then hearing no further questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2125. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2173. And we have Jeff Carter, former president of the Oregon State Bar here. Mr. Carter, introduce this.
That's okay. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Carter, and I am a private practitioner in juvenile law here in Marion County. I'm actually a member of the juvenile consortium that delivers legal services to both dependency and delinquency cases. Kind of at the 11th hour, I was asked, and I think my office is about two blocks from here, so that might have something to do with it. But at any rate, I'm happy to be here and happy to have had an opportunity to review 2173. OCDLA asked me to take a peek at it, and I wrote down that I'm neutral, and I think actually if I had a leaning, it would be in support of this. This is an area, from a practitioner standpoint, that really does need to be addressed. And I really want to commend the efforts behind bringing forth something like 2173. From a practicing standpoint, the process is too slow, and it varies between every state that you deal with. And I think the intent and purpose behind this is actually to speed up the process. Paragraph A under Article 1 specifically states that, and also to bring some consistency between the states. So this is a good thing. What I did was I went through the bill itself, and I guess my real position is I think that this bill probably could benefit from a small group here locally taking a look at it from maybe a little bit broader perspective, both from the judiciary and maybe some practitioners to offer a little bit of assistance. There are some things that I identified, and I can give you some examples, and this is actually just from a plain reading of the statute over the last 24 hours, so, and I'm not an interstate compact expert, but it is one of those things that we come across almost on a daily basis in our practice when we're representing both parents and children. And I just want to point out a couple examples. One is just on page 4, paragraph 4, where they talk about the non-custodial parent placement. And there's a couple court findings that are required, both from the sending state and also the, sending state making findings in connection with the relationship of the non-custodial parent making certain written findings. And the first, I guess, kind of question I had is whether or not this would work under a kind of a Troxel analysis, that it requires a substantial relationship with a child. And just in way of background, Troxel is a case that came out of the state of Washington that put at interest or at issue a parent's rights versus a grandparent's rights. And the decision for the Supreme Court kind of caused a domino effect in a number of states, including Oregon, to reevaluate their psychological parent statutes, guardian or grandparent statute. And I think what we have now at Chapter 109-119, I believe, is Oregon's answer to the Troxel question. And I guess the first question I would have is whether or not these findings that are required by the state would be appropriate under a Troxel analysis. Another area that I kind of looked at was on page 5, paragraph C. Talks about the sending state being able to dismiss jurisdiction only if the receiving state concurs. I mean, my approach to this has always been finding of jurisdiction, dismissal of jurisdiction is kind of a judiciary function, and my reading of the statute would indicate that the receiving state could trump a judicial determination, and I'm not sure if that's would hold up under a separation of powers type of an analysis. And again, I'm not a constitutional expert. I also asked a question. They talk about the public agencies' assessments on the receiving state and whether or not that resource in that state, either whether it be a non-custodial parent or relative or non-relative, whether It would be an idea that we would open it up to allow private assessments like we do in adoption areas where we have private adoption agencies do those. Again, just with the idea of speeding up the process. And then at one other, and I'll end this. I've got a court appearance at 10:30, and I appreciate the committee's allowing me to go first. There is on page 6, line 23, there's a discussion about an objection to a receiving state's finding. The way I understand the bill is that there's a request put in from the sending state, goes to the receiving state, they make an assessment, and I think it is appropriate to have some kind of an administrative review or other review of that decision. The concern that I have, it says any interested party could bring that, and probably the most important party to the process is the child. And this, for instance, will say Oregon is a sending state, maybe it's New York is a receiving state. I'm not sure if the child would have appropriate representation in the receiving state. The representation for the child is here in the sending state. So. And it was those types of things. This kind of, again, it was just over the last 24 hours a review of the statute. And I just want to say this is a really good thing that is being looked at. It does need to be addressed, and I want to commend all the hard work that went into. Obviously, there's hours and hours of work that went into this, but I'd just like to see maybe a small group here, and in talking with the agency representatives, I think that might be, not to steal their thunder, but might be something that they would consider. So that's kind of where I'm coming in at, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Committee, we've got limited time for a couple of bills that I want to spend some attention on, and this bill will need to be worked further. So unless there are questions that need to be put of Mr. Carter, I think we'll excuse him so he can get to his court appearance on time. Hear briefly from Harry Gilmore, the other witness who signed up.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Harry Gilmore, and I am the manager of the Technical Assistance Unit at Department of Human Services, Division of Children, Adults, and Families. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2173. Passage of the bill would enact the Interstate Compact for the Placement of Children in the state of Oregon, and it would make Oregon a member of the Interstate Compact. There is an existing interstate compact for the placement of children, of which Oregon and the other 49 states and Washington, D.C. are members. The rewrite of this compact was initiated by the American Public Human Services Association in Washington, D.C., and they took input from representatives from all the states and other parties that are affected by interstate placements, and worked a couple of years on developing this new version of the compact. The existing children's compact is 47 years old, and there are a number of commonly perceived shortcomings with the agreement that we have in place now. One of the primary issues is just the basic question of applicability of the compact, which types of interstate placements it covers and which ones it doesn't. And that's one of the primary issues that this new compact seeks to address by having very clear language and having up-to-date language describing the types of placements that are covered by the compact and those that are not covered. It has an entire section devoted to that single question, and it's something that's severely lacking in the current agreement. Another problem that it seeks to address is the issue of enforcement. As the previous testifier mentioned, every single state sort of has its own way of interpreting the current agreement, and we, not just in terms of applicability, but when it comes to the issue of dismissing jurisdiction that was mentioned, when it's okay to do that and when it's not. There are just a number of issues that the states essentially do not agree on for a couple of reasons. One, they're not explicitly addressed in the current agreement, and two, the rules that go along with the current agreement are not clearly enforceable, and they're not developed in a way that's open to public comment, and there are not provisions in the current compact for the development of rules and the promulgation of rules. And so when rules are promulgated in the way that's been decided upon informally by the existing governing body, they're open to legal challenge, they're open to interpretation, and they're generally ignored if a state doesn't feel like they agree with the rule that's written by the existing governing body. Under the new compact, an interstate commission is formed, and each member state has a single representative on that commission, and that commission is charged with the creation of rules that will essentially operationalize the compact. The basic requirements are outlined in the statute contained in House Bill 2173, but there's a lot of details about the day-to-day operation that aren't laid out in the statute, and that was done purposefully so that if they need to change in the future, that they can be changed through this rulemaking process as needed. However, the rules that are made by the body will be made in a way that's open to public comment through a system of due process, and there are also enforcement provisions so that a state cannot unilaterally decide that a rule doesn't apply to them or to interpret the rule in their own way. The previous testifier also mentioned that the current process is time-consuming and can be very inefficient, and the new compact attempts to address that also by requiring that the rulemaking body establish timelines for the process within the first 12 months. There are no timelines in the current compact. It talks about the need to have approval from another state before you send a child from one state to another, but there's no requirement for a state to grant that approval or its denial within any specified time, and that will change under the new compact. The only other thing I want to mention is that there is an advantage to being one of the early adopters of the new compact. It will not take effect nationally until a minimum of 35 states have enacted it. If Oregon is not among those initial 35 states, we will not have an opportunity to vote as a state in the promulgation of rules that will occur in that first 12 months after it takes effect. So there is an advantage to be among the first 35 states that adopt the agreement. And I also mentioned that the U.S. Congress has recommended passage of the Interstate Compact in the sense of the Congress section of the Safe and Timely Interstate Placement of Foster Children Act that recently passed in July of last year. Any
Mr.
questions?
Gilmore, are you in agreement that there's more work that needs to be done on the bill? We did these comments from Mr. Carter, and are you amenable then to trying to work out the common ground in these points?
Absolutely. We're limited to some degree because this is a uniform statute that requires all states to adopt the substantially same version of the statute. However, there's style changes that could occur. Committee counsel has pointed out that there are some problems with the wording and some of the terms that are used aren't could be improved upon, and we can do things like that, and we've done things like that with other compacts, whereas we don't substantially change the intent, that we can change the wording and we can make it more clear and still not nullify the compact in terms of our relationship with other states.
Well, I would ask you to participate in that process, but be watching that point, that is, to make sure that we don't, in effect, nullify our participation and by departing too much from what the compact language is.
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, one way we can do that is by vetting any changes that we make with the American Public Human Services Association, who are the as I said, the primary authors of this new compact, and the Council on State Governments also had a role in that, and they've expressed their willingness to look at any changes that we make, and they've expressed their openness to changes that'll clarify the meaning, and they could probably offer a review of it to determine whether we are making changes that might affect whether it would nullify the agreement or not. So,
okay. Well, unless there are pressing questions from the committee, why don't we close the public hearing on House Bill 2173, and I'm going to open jointly hearings on House Bill 2136 and 2137 because they raise parallel issues. And as I indicated at the start of this meeting, we will not be taking these to a work session today, but I want to introduce the ideas which are somewhat overlapping between them. So opening the hearing on House Bills 2136 and 2137. Mr. Fussner from the Department of Justice, could you explain to us what these bills are about?
Person and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jonathan Fussner. I am the attorney in charge of the Criminal Appeals Unit in the Appellate Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bills 2136 and 2137. What I would like to do is to do two things. First, give you a brief description of what the bills are intended to do. And second, probably more important, to explain why the Department of Justice decided to have these bills drafted up. As I'm sure you know, when a person is convicted of any criminal offense in any of the circuit courts around the state of Oregon, they are entitled by statute to appeal to the Court of Appeals here in Salem. When they do that, the lawyers in my office represent the state of Oregon in those appeals in the Court of Appeals. This involves a certain amount of work. And while most of the cases that we handle are crimes ranging from misdemeanors such as drunk driving, assaults, all the way up to serious Measure 11 felonies and aggravated murder cases carrying the death penalty, some of the appeals that we handle, not very many, but some, are violation offenses. And what violations are simply charges for which only a fine can be imposed, no jail time. And these include, there are quite a range of them. They include traffic offenses like speeding. They include minor in possession of alcohol, possession of less than an ounce of marijuana, a number of other offenses, and misdemeanor crimes that have been reduced to violations by the district attorneys. What these bills would do would be eliminate the right of appeal to the Court of Appeals in most of those violation cases. As you can see from the bill itself and from the written testimony I've submitted, what it essentially does is eliminate appeals from traffic violation convictions and from non-traffic violation convictions where a fine of under $500 was imposed. The second question is why, and I want to be very clear about my answer here, to save money. This bill arose out of the difficulties that the Appellate Division has had over the last biennium in handling its workload. We conducted a head-to-toe review of what we do, how we do it, and we look for ways to be more efficient and to use the limited lawyer resources that we have to handle the caseload that we're supposed to handle. And we concluded that one way that we could save some money would be to eliminate these violation appeals on the grounds that they are the least significant and important cases that come to the Court of Appeals. As I said, you look at all the criminal cases in the Court of Appeals, and then you look at traffic violations or other violation offenses, and I think any reasonable observer would say, if you're going to eliminate the appeals in any case, that's probably where you would want to cut, and not have your Department of Justice lawyers spending a certain amount of taxpayer money handling these relatively small-scale, relatively less significant cases. I would like to say one thing, though, and that is, please understand that the Department of Justice and certainly the people that I work with in the appellate division are not hostile to the notion of having appeals in these kinds of cases. We like appeals. That's what we do. We live to handle appeals. And in an ideal world, we are perfectly happy to do these cases. We have discovered we're not living in an ideal world. We're living in a world with limited resources. And these cases just strike us as the kind of cases that if we're going to eliminate this kind of attorney work, these are the cases in which to do it. If I can just make one other observation, it's important to realize that these cases are tried without court-appointed attorneys at the trial level because being non-criminal violations, people are not entitled to have appointed counsel. District attorneys ordinarily do not appear in these cases. It is usually the citing officer and the defendant and any other witnesses that either one of them wants to call. These are tried without juries. There's no right to a jury trial in these cases. And in fact, the only place in the system where lawyers get involved in these cases is when they come up on appeal, and still the appellant, the defendant, has no right to an appointed attorney on appeal either. So these are largely handled by the defendant pro se, that is, without a lawyer. The only place where lawyers get involved is Department of Justice lawyers. My lawyers represent the state in these cases. And as you will see from my written testimony, we are currently billing at $128, I believe it is, an hour. We recently had a case that involved a traffic appeal in which the Solicitor General, the head of the appellate division, handled this case for the state. The fine was $109. She had to spend well over a day reading the transcript, researching the law, writing the brief, responding to a big, thick, heavy brief that had been filed by the pro se appellant. And the disparity in cost between the amount of attorney time and effort that went into this appeal versus the fact this was a small, comparatively insignificant traffic case is what really has prompted this bill. So the bottom line I would say to you is the legislature can make policy choice. If you would like us to continue to have these cases come into the Court of Appeals and to represent the state, we will do that. We've been doing it up to now, even with the limited resources that we've had. If, on the other hand, we want to contract the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals a little bit, lessen the workload a little bit, this is probably the kind of case that we safely could eliminate from the appeals system. Having said that, I'm happy to attempt to answer any questions that the committee probably has.
Representative Krieger.
$28,000. What we're talking about, you know, kind of the court appeals to me is a pretty cheap price for justice in the case to some people who have been maybe dealt a dirty hand. The way this is written now, unless I hear some testimony far different, I'm willing to, as a legislator and as a citizen, to invest in that because our sight should always be on justice and fairness. And if we try to take that away, you start here, you start chipping away at this sort of thing. And that brings me some real consternation down the line. You can start here. Where does it go?
Representative Barker.
Mr. Pastor, how would something be resolved in Multnomah County if you're not familiar with the bicycle, the no-brake bikes? Now, you have one judge saying those bikes are legal and another judge saying they're not legal. How would something like that get resolved? I mean, I understand, I certainly and sympathize with the position about the huge cost for a violation, but how could something like that be resolved? I mean, just depending on what day you draw or what ticket you draw, whether you're going to be found guilty or not guilty.
Well, Chair McPherson and Representative Barker, I think you have identified one of the many arguments in favor of continuing to have appeals in these cases, and that is appeals are one way to resolve differing rulings among different trial judges. And there's no escaping the fact that if this bill were enacted, that appellate remedy would go away for certain limited, relatively small amount cases. And again, I think that's simply a judgment call that is for you to make. We are largely presenting this as one option, not so much we don't want to have these appeals anymore. We understand the benefit of them, and that's what we have largely been doing in the appellate division, is handling appeals for exactly that reason. They're important. They do a lot of good.
Chairman Kirsten.
Yeah, Representative Bonamici.
I wanted to share Representative Krieger's concerns, and especially with regard to the message that we send to the public about some cases aren't as valuable enough, or some people's rights aren't valuable enough for the state to care about, and that's a concern for me. And I guess that's more of a statement than a question, but I would urge you to find other ways to save $28,000 rather than this issue, because it just I think sends the wrong message to the public.
Mr. Fussner, are there any statistics on the reversal rate when appeals are taken from these cases?
I can't give you specific statistics, but we did take a look at the cases over the last couple of years, and we had, it varies from year to year, we had roughly 20 cases of violation appeals per year. And I think it is safe to say that virtually all of those are affirmed by the Court of Appeals without writing an opinion. The two cases that I can think of in the last few years where the court has actually written on this issue involved the photo radar system, which was a new system. It was challenged on appeal on a variety of grounds, and those were violation cases. The Court of Appeals wrote about whether the photo radar system was lawful or not. And we had a case that got some publicity, certainly in the Portland area, involving a bicyclist who had been cited for obstructing traffic by walking his bicycle along the sidewalk during one of these critical mass or other bicycle protest cases or situations. And in that case, we reviewed the appeal. We concluded that that was an incorrect application of that statute, and we conceded error, and the Court of Appeals reversed that conviction. So it does happen. There aren't very many of these overall, and almost all of them are resolved by affirmed without opinion by the court.
Okay. We're running short on time, so what I'd like to do, committee, if we could, is to hear from some folks that I surmise are opponents of the bill before we run out of time. So, Mr. Fussner, if we could excuse you and invite, in fact, if we could hear from maybe both Ann Christian and Andrea Meyer, would come forward. I'm surmising you're both may have compatible perspectives.
We are. Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Meyer, and I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, and as this is my first time before this committee this session, I wanted to briefly explain that the ACLU protects the civil liberties and civil rights of folks through both the Oregon and Federal Bill of Rights, including due process issues, which we'll discuss today. The organization has existed over 80 years nationally, and this year we celebrate our 52nd year in Oregon. We have thousands of members,
all across the state in all of your districts. We are nonpartisan, and we do not support or oppose candidates, but we do get involved in initiatives and legislation, education, and litigation. So I'm here today to oppose both these House bills 2136 and 2137 because of serious due process concerns that we have, and I think the committee has grasped. You all get phone calls from constituents about getting tickets and violations and other things, and it was unfair and it wasn't right. And you can probably usually assure them that they can go through the judicial process and will have the necessary safeguards there through the appeal. I can't imagine what it's going to be like when they get a violation and they think the law was incorrectly applied by the officer or by the court, and they have no opportunity to get the law reviewed. So there are unintended consequences. And while the Department of Justice spoke about some areas, I wanted to just briefly touch on the fact that there are violations that will arise under the boating laws, traffic, wildlife, commercial fishing, and Oregon Forest Practices Acts. These are not just state violations, but there are also city, county ordinances that if they don't go to a justice court, for instance, in Multnomah County, they go to the circuit court, and that's the first time. Now, sometimes judges get it wrong. And in the trial court, sometimes they get it right. Sometimes judges in the same district get two different opinions. So what we're creating is a dynamic where not only 36 counties can have a different interpretation of a law that you all passed, but as you've heard earlier, different judges within that courthouse. And the only way we get to resolve that is by going to the Court of Appeals, because when the Court of Appeals speaks, now the whole state is instructed as to how to interpret that law, so that you don't have unequal justice depending on what day of the week it is, what court, or what judge. Now, I have to put on my slightly personal hat for a moment and talk about a little bit about photo radar, having had a little bit of experience in that and reviewing some law. And here's another effect. It's not just a question of overturning, as Representative McPherson asked, what's the rate on that, but it's also clarifying the law. And I know the justices spoke to you last week about their role in interpreting the statutes that you passed. So there are two statutes related to photo radar, ORS 810-438 and 439, that instruct jurisdictions on what they're required to do. And my recollection, I haven't reviewed this, but they've been passed at different times and at different sessions. But ORS 810-439 declares, notwithstanding any other provision of the law, only 7 enumerated conditions are required for an issuance of a valid speeding citation based on photo radar evidence. Well, there were other conditions that were to be met in the other section. But the court here said that doesn't matter, because the way the statute reads is, notwithstanding any other provision of the law, it's only these 7. The defendant there had to agree that those 7 had been met, but argued that the other ones had not been met. So now the Court of Appeals has spoken, and if you all want to revisit the issue, this at least you know how your law is being interpreted, that part of photo radar actually may not be applied in the way you thought. If we couldn't get that up to the Court of Appeals, you've got trial judges across the state trying to figure out what it means and coming up with different answers. And you may never be aware of that, because one thing that happens when the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court issues a decision, you all know that's now the rule of law in the state of Oregon. And then you have the opportunity to come back and say, that's not what we intended, that's not what we want, and we're going to fix the law now that the Court of Appeals has given us the interpretation. So the other just quick point I wanted to make in terms of, and it goes both ways. It may be the defendant who says you interpreted the law incorrectly and I shouldn't get the photo radar ticket, or it could be the city or the state that gets a decision about photo radar doesn't count here anymore. Well, if they can't appeal that, they're also stuck with interpretations that might not be the best for the process. The DOJ mentioned that only lawyers who get involved are DOJ lawyers, and just for the record, that's not always correct. I know photo radar folks get lawyers. They've litigated this. That's how that case, Kolish, came before the court. There are ramifications with licensing and tickets. So for all those reasons, we urge you not to move forward with these two bills, and I thank you for the opportunity today and would be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ann Christian. I represent Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers. And the only thing I'm going to add, because I agree with what Ms. Meyer has said and also with many of the things Mr. Fusner and members of this committee have said, is I did practice law in Portland for a period of time, and I had a few clients who did take violation proceedings up on appeal. And here's kind of the novel twist I would put on it, that if someone were to determine to do away with these minor, quote-unquote, violation trials, thinking of those specific clients that I had, they are very time-consuming, and they are very many of them unhappy with the government. And I just have to wonder, having spent a lot of time with those clients, that if doing away with their right to appeal on a violation, that would save Department of Justice time and perhaps Court of Appeals time, but I just wonder what that would do as far as other agencies and elected officials' time, including your own. So that's the only thing I would add. Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Well, it's hard to understand that police officers might not be unfollowable, these two at least. But I don't care if it's the state, police, sheriff, city. Periodically, we have people that I don't believe belong in a uniform. And if there is no consequence appeal that can bring these types of things forward, I think it would leave us open to more mischief. And so I just want to put that perspective on it.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee and Representative Krieger, certainly present company excluded. And sometimes police officers are following what they understand is the law. And so no ill will on their part, but the law happens to be unclear. And so law enforcement needs the guidance that when they're enforcing these, if there's a question about what the statute or the ordinance meant, that they can do their job well.
Okay. Any further questions? Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably more in the context of commentary. First, I came here today very troubled by these two bills, and I thank you for your discretion not to move to work session on these. And secondly, actually, I know Ms. Meyer and I have probably not been on the same side of arguments often, but I am in thorough agreement with her in this matter. As a matter of fact, I was thinking of calling the ACLU about that.
You're right.
Thank you.
Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, I appreciate the opportunity to come and probably testify, maybe for the only time this session, but hopefully not, where it truly is what I hope will be bipartisan support, and that you understand where the ACLU is so important.
And Mr. Chair, I would just add, I think that I appreciate the Department of Justice's effort to look at low-hanging fruit and cost-saving endeavors, but I think that the price of citizen rights is too high a price.
I think we've kicked the horse enough.
Okay, thank you, witnesses.
Thank you.
We have one other witness signed up, Carl Myers. Anything to add in view of the emotional climate you're sensing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Carl Myers. I am the current president of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association. I'm also here representing the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. I just want you to know I concur with the statements made in opposition. My judges have serious concerns about the bill. We actually enjoy to a judge the ability of our customers, both the state or the prosecution and the defense, to have redress if we if they think we have made a decision on these kinds of matters. I'm also concerned from a personal matter that if you pass these bills, I will have no reason to read the advance sheets, and I look forward to that occasion. So thank you. I offer my services not only on this bill but other bills that you might have dealing with the local courts, the municipal courts, the justice courts, and any of the issues that are brought before them. So you may see me from time to time on that behalf. If you do not have any questions, thank you very much.
Okay. If there are no questions for the committee, then thank you, Mr. Myers, and we will close the public hearing on House Bills 2136 and 2137. And that concludes our work for today. The committee is adjourned.